And now,
from the didgeridoo to 140 miles east of Kalamazoo, at least as far as Google Maps says, this version is a tribute to Motown.
Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Okay, this is Phil Lairness. This is your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. And over in Motor City, experiencing one hell of a heat wave, it's the Motor City Madman, Dean Haglund. What's the temperature reading there now?
The heat wave is on the mend. Here, early in the morning, it's only 82 degrees.
The heat wave is on the mend is right up there with the eagle has landed for call signs, Dean Haglund. The heat wave is on the mend. Oh, Dean made it. He made it to the moon.
I made it. However, humidity is still 75%, down from the 88% when it was 110 degrees. And that's Michigan. So imagine Georgia or somewhere that way.
Well, Dean, when it gets down to 60, sell.
Yeah.
That's some of the rock solid comedy that you've come to expect from your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. I'm not going to lie to you. We're recording on a Sunday. One of us, not Dean, a bit hungover.
What? What'd you do?
Partied like it was my job last night. Party over at Steve Lem. Good friend, good groomsman, Steve Lem's house.
Oh, my gosh. That guy can party.
Oh, yeah. So a lot of wines, a lot of great food. I mean, a meal of, you know, 8 courses, maybe. A cheese and meat course at like 1:30 in the morning.
What better time to enjoy the subtle varieties?
Oh, there were apple. Oh, hey, so apropos of this dinner, can I ask you something? Because you are a guy who knows a thing or two about cooking and about how to cook vegetables. I remember so fondly you getting boxes of produce there to the condo. And sometimes you could ask for certain things, but you didn't know what was going to be in the box. And you would be like whipping up this stuff.
I'm competing on Chopped.
Exactly. And sometimes it was seriously, I'm not even joking. I mean, it would be things that I could not, I don't mean your meal, what you were preparing, but the ingredients, the vegetables would sometimes be things I could not recognize. I couldn't name. And that's,
you could tell your rutabaga from a ground squash or a gourd.
Exactly. I mean, I don't even understand what you just said to me. But
I named 3 vegetables in a row.
But I was introduced to the charms, the delights of the sunchoke last night.
Oh, yes. The sunchoke artichoke is sometimes.
Well, it's not an artichoke, and it's not a potato. It looks just like a potato. It when you cook it, it even looks more like a potato, but it's the heart of the sunflower. And it's called the sunchoke. And the texture is like a potato. It tastes like a sweet, fresh corn is what it tastes like.
Wow.
Fantastic.
That's fancy.
Fantastic. Sunchoke for anyone who calls into the show today on me. All right. Hey, Dean, we've been talking so much about what makes great television. What can lead to great television over the last couple of weeks. And the Emmy nominations came out right under our noses.
Just like that.
And we used to cover things like this, the Emmy nominations, in detail. And
right.
We really haven't. Yeah, we really haven't.
Right.
But I was just struck. I don't know if anything struck you about the nominations. I mean, there's the obvious that, boy, the networks don't make quality stuff compared to streaming outlets anymore, let alone your premium cable outlets, right? The HBOs, which still dominate. But I was also struck at just how many excellent comedy shows and how delightful it is, even though I don't watch this show and I'm dying to know if you do, but that the Canadian program Schitt's Creek finally got some Emmy love. It was nominated for Best Comedy Series. Is this a show that you've been watching?
I've watched a couple episodes. Friends of mine, of course, in it, and occasionally I will tune in. The premise may be a bit threadbare for my taste, but I like where they go with stuff, and it's got funny, unforeseen left turns. So there's many a joy to be found in the episode, but I'm hate to say I'm not avid as the editing machine that is known to be. I am not an avid watcher of Schitt's Creek. So I think perhaps maybe I will step it up, because maybe this sounds like now they've improved some of the quality of whatever they've been working on.
Well, I certainly love that Eugene Levy, the great
yes.
Eugene Levy. We can say that, the beloved Eugene Levy, and truly an international treasure, since he hails from Canada. First Emmy nomination since 1983, since SCTV back in 1983.
Ow.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. And it comes in a show, of course, created by his son. So that's a feel-good story. Another feel-good story for me is not only, of course, Barry Season 2 nominated. It won for Season 1. Bill Hader won a much-deserved Emmy for Best Actor in a Comedy. And Henry Winkler. Oh, my God. Talk about a guy who's been at it a long time and maybe finally getting his due for what a great actor he is, though I think all of us knew it, right?
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, his work in Barry, just spectacular. And so his wins the Emmy for Supporting Actor last year. So all of them nominated again, but also nominated in the Supporting Actor category opposite Mr. Winkler and the likes, of course, of the great Tony Hale on Veep, is Anthony Corrigan in Barry. You know, the bald Chechenian wannabe gangster. He is so funny. And one of my favorite things in Barry is to watch in scenes that he does with Bill Hader and see how often Bill Hader's staring at the ground. And I recognize it for what it is and found out, sure enough, that's it. That Anthony Corrigan just ruins take after take after take by busting Bill Hader up so much with what he's doing. And so often Bill Hader's just staring at the ground, making it look like he's so angry because he's just trying so hard not to laugh.
And you met that guy recently, didn't you?
Yeah, not that long ago. That's a great memory when I was doing one of the run-throughs at the Vista Theater before the wedding. And he had been there seeing a movie, and it was kind of a big deal. It was one of those celebrity sightings, though I don't think he was quite a celebrity yet because he didn't have the Emmy nomination.
Right.
Yeah, so just a dude in the neighborhood who's doing amazing, amazing work on Barry. I also, of course, love Good Place getting another nomination leading into its final season. They announced at Comic-Con that it would be the final season coming up. And I don't know if you saw the photos, Dean, of the cast at Comic-Con, the cast of The Good Place. Did you see these?
No.
It's like they're at a funeral.
Oh, no.
They're crying. They look really disturbed. really upset. And I don't think it because it was news to them, but, you know, they're filming the final season right now. They may have filmed already a lot of it. And it launches in September. But, you know, one of them described it as breaking up with someone when you're still in love with them.
No. No.
But that's kind of a good way to go out, though.
It is, yeah. Before you're all saying, I hate you, I hate you. Or, you know.
Or, like we said.
The steam has ran out of your performance.
Yeah. Like we said, how hard it is to nail the dismount on these shows. And apparently, they're going out because they know how to end it. So, and it'll be in a mind-bending fashion, as the show is. So
that's good. Now, I've forgotten, because I've been watching it down under, I'm not even sure where I am in the whole season layout.
So you're saying you're going to have to rewatch some of it and catch up and get back up to speed.
Again. Yes.
And that's,
how exciting is that?
That's the first segue for the real first theme that I want to discuss with you. And it's, you know, it's an old bugaboo of mine now, but it's the issue of binge watching. And, and it's this very thing that you mentioned, because our friend Mark Hirschhorn, made a post about this, about, how he and his wife, were going to watch the new season of a show that they've been watching. And as the season started, they realized they needed to go back and watch the final episode of the season before to remember where they were at. And then they realized that, well, that didn't really help. And they ended up going back and watching almost the whole season again. And I'm not saying that they necessarily binge watched the previous season, but I do think that binge watching exacerbates this thing that all of us know, which is we have this experience again and again. Seasons begin and we go, okay, wait a minute. Who is that character again? Now, what is their connection? We're forgetting lots of things. And I will tell you that to me is a sign that all of these shows are too plot driven. Because when they're character driven, we have greater recollection. And I'm realizing this about myself. I'm realizing it with movies. How often I'll see movies and I'll go, that was a good movie. And within months, I literally don't remember anything that happened in it.
You know, funny you should say that. Kingsman 2 was on while I was scrolling around on the HBO, and I just went, wait, when did this poppy? What the hell? Like all the major set pieces, all the major action, all the major character, like all of it. What?
And it was just, and this made me think about. So I watched, apropos of the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, which we'll talk about in a little bit, I watched a lot of kind of space adventure films.
yeah, right.
You know, some directly related, like Wright Stuff, saw that again. Robert Altman's Countdown, his first feature film, it's called, though it wasn't. He had made 12 years earlier, he had made some, like The Delinquents. But his first big comeback after doing documentary shorts and television. So I've been watching some of these, and one of the ones that I watched was from the great French filmmaker Claire Denis, starring Robert Pattinson. It's this year's High Life. And I realized when I was thinking about this topic, a binge versus character, that I gave a rather not bad, not a pan. But I was underwhelmed by a critical darling that Claire Denis made last year, a film that kind of deconstructed romantic comedy archetypes called Let the Sunshine In, starring the peerless Juliette Binoche. And
right.
This got such great acclaim, and it didn't do it for me. It didn't work for me. I was distinctly unhappy and without joy watching the movie, and I stuck with it. But it boring isn't the word. I don't tend to find things boring. I think only boring people find things boring.
Right.
We can always find interest. There's always something to activate us and engage us if we're willing to put in some work. But it and a good time. That's not something I'm necessarily looking for. But for whatever it was, it you know, I wasn't moved. I was disturbed professionally. It just wasn't working for me. But when I was thinking about this and how we all forget entire seasons of shows that we enjoyed watching, so much so that we're looking forward to the new season, and then, oh my God, I don't remember what was going on. Who are these characters? I remember everything about Let the Sun Shine In.
Yeah.
And when I realized that I remember everything about the Let the Sun Shine In, I actually found a strange thing had gone on inside me, which is I love that movie.
Yeah. What?
And I love that movie because I really love that character that Juliette Binoche was playing. And so I no longer... It's like a road trip with Dean Hagland.
Nah, it's boring.
It may be hours of hair-pulling frustration punctuated by one or two good laughs. But in retrospect, I wouldn't trade it for the world.
Right, which was some of your favorite times in a car.
Exactly. No, but that's it comes down to this idea that for me, I feel like I went through something with this character. I shared not only her ordeal, but my ordeal of sitting through the movie, of watching it. And I realized, wow, a lot of the things that I didn't like, it was because I didn't like that it was happening to her.
So you were had total empathy. The word is empathy.
Yeah. And so I'm disagreeing with choices because I don't want the character to have to be doing what I'm witnessing. And maybe it's because I don't like that I'm witnessing it. And so anyway, so the point is, I really do love that movie because I loved getting to spend time with that character. And isn't that how our memory works, right? We don't often remember the plot details of what we did, but the depth and the breadth of what we remember is often dependent on who we experienced it with.
Well, it's funny you should bring this up because there is something that has caught my eye on the old retro TV platform called Amazon Prime Video. And if you dig deep below, they have episodes of Peter Gunn with two N's, starring Craig Stevens, written, directed, and created by Blake Edwards, who later went on to do the original Peter Sellers and Inspector Clouseau, the Pink Panther series. So if you watch this, it is all of 23 to 26 minutes long. It is hard-boiled crime drama and Henry Mancini scoring every episode himself with the signature, you'll recognize the show's theme song,
And in case you don't, spoiler alert, I'm now going to use it for our closing music. Please go on.
Fantastic. What's amazing is, when you watch it in comparison to modern television, the plot is so thin. It is paper thin. Maybe there's a car explosion. Maybe some gangster something. Peter Gunn goes to some massively colorful characters. So obviously they are taking the proverbial rake through the early method acting studios of New York and Los Angeles and finding these young, emotional, holy smokes, over the top performances, not even over the top. They're like really, really straight out of acting class and onto the camera. And then kind of wraps it up. And there's a jazz sequence maybe in there somewhere that he's gone into some jazz club to find some bad guy. And then invariably, everybody just gets shot. There's no criminal proceedings. Just everybody's dead. Cue the Mancini music. And it is. You go, what? How is that even getting past a storyboard meeting? And yet here it is, and it is memorable. Oh, my gosh.
It's so pleasing. It's so pleasing, right?
So ridiculously pleasing. And I don't know if it's the sorbet to the constant steady stream of the heavy meats that television is today or what? But
well, I told you about how I binged the 40-something episodes of the original Danger Man, Patrick McGoohan's yes. show where he plays John Drake, the iteration, the half-hour iteration before it would come back following the spy boom, you know, because it predated James Bond. Ian Fleming creates the character, introduces a lot of the tropes, and then the spy boom happens because of James Bond, and then they bring it back later in an hour form as Secret Agent. And the half hour is exactly what you're describing. In fact, I like it better than the hour version because the hour version, they kind of just pad it out with plot. But in those early half hour black and white incarnations, it was so pleasing. And at a time when I was, you know, really in the throes of dealing with the pain and the frustration of not being able to see, I gravitated towards this because more than for my affinity of McGoohan's work, though there was that, it was because the black and white photography was a lot easier for me to see than anything in color. So that's why I gravitated towards it. And damn if I wasn't, I had to watch one every night before going to bed. It was so pleasing to spend the time with that character. And that is why we used to go back to shows. Again right. and again and again, week after week, in the old broadcast model, when there was a week between shows, sometimes you might come back because, oh, that plot was pleasing. But usually it was because, oh, I want to visit these characters again. I need to visit these characters. I need to see what these characters are up to. We love the original Star Trek. We love Star Trek The Next Generation because of those years we spent with the characters and how we got to know them, even though for the most part they weren't continuing storylines.
Right.
And if you have great characters, then the show will work, and it'll work through lesser scripts because the characters themselves are still interesting and you still enjoy spending time with them, and even the lesser episodes help inform the better episodes. Just like friendships, just like relationships, right?
Right.
It's not the great trips that you took together that inform the friendships and the relationships. It's the quiet, it's the everyday, it's the mundane, it's the banal. That yes. you know, the beauty is in the banal. And so this is what television mastered for decades. And the introduction of the ability to have ongoing plots and storylines and the ability now to watch it in rapid succession has, I think, upended the apple cart, and its weight is too unevenly distributed to that side of the equation.
Yeah, right? So that now everybody's, because now you're doing 9-hour movies, basically, that are single plots.
Or you're doing 17-hour movies without plots. I'm looking at you, the best show of all time, Twin Peaks The Return. Okay. Dean, 12 years ago,
yes.
We were talking about Comic-Con.
Right.
And so we're going to play a little clip of this, but you listened to this clip.
I did.
Before we play it, what stood out for you?
That I've been going to Comic-Con a long time.
But I was wondering whether or not, because you haven't been for a while.
Yeah, it's been 6-7 years.
And so I was curious, and then we'll play it, but do you miss it?
Well, let's play the clip, because I in my voice you can hear the future that I was not too happy about where Comic-Con was going, so...
Okay, fair enough. So that clip is this clip is illustrative of where we were heading, where your relationship to Comic-Con was, and it was illustrative of where we were heading in terms of what we're going to be talking about too on the other side. Because boy, Star Trek sure was a topic of discussion in the clip, wasn't it?
Yeah, right. And it is again.
My gosh.
Hey, aren't you going to Comic-Con this week?
This is the week of Comic-Con when 150,000 not just fans of comics, not the just geeks and nerds. It's Hollywood. It's like the third largest Hollywood event after Sundance and Toronto Film Festivals, I'd say. There's launches. There's secret panel discussions on new upcoming movies, TV shows. I personally am going to go to the Adult Swim Cartoon Network's panel where they always talk about what their next seasons are going to look like for years to come. Also, what other movies are going to be showing. They don't show the movies. They show clips from the movies. I understand J.J. Abrams' 18 remake of The Host, the one 18. Did you see that trailer? Did I send you that link?
No, that's what it is, though. It's a remake of The Host.
Yes.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah. Because for those of you who haven't seen it, it basically looks like some home video footage of some party in New York. And then suddenly there's a giant disaster. They all look outside. There's something huge and flaming. And they all run to the street. And the head of the Statue of Liberty comes barreling down the street, knocking cars over. And it all looks like it's shot on a home handycam. I love
it.
Yes. So anyway, that's the sort of things going on at Comic-Con.
They're also going to be announcing finally the cast for the new Star Trek movie, I heard.
Yeah, I don't know if they got a fully...
That's supposed to be what they're announcing. Abrams is there and he's announcing it. They start shooting in a couple months. Yeah. So they're going to be making the big announcement about it. We already know that Nimoy is on.
Right.
And heard that possibly Shatner, but then we don't know who will be playing the young versions of.
What do you want to put some money on this?
Well, I really kind of did like the Matt Damon idea, and but
as a Kirk?
Yeah.
Wow.
Because he really looks like young Shatner, but the thing that I particularly always thought was, I mean, he's a great actor, so maybe they wouldn't be able to get him, but Adrian Brody as Spock, I thought was perfect.
Oh, interesting.
You know, he really, physically, the young Nimoy, he looks a lot like it. He's got the acting depth, because Spock is a hell of a character.
Yeah.
So I like that.
That's a good one.
And, you know,
I
the big rumor about Gary Sinise as McCoy was really delightful. I mean, he was kind of born to be DeForest Kelly.
It was, yeah.
So Comic-Con first, Dean, because, of course, Comic-Con is going on right now. You don't tend to be a nostalgic person.
I tend not to be nostalgic, is correct.
So this did not stir any wish. Oh, I want to go back. You pretty well know there is no going back to the Comic-Con you enjoyed.
Right, because no one's there for comics. No one reads comics. There's no real comic book artists there anymore. Everybody works digitally, so you can't even get original panels anymore. Some people just paint one or two pictures if they still have a booth and just sell those one or two for 10 grand. And then that sort of covers their nut for the hotel and travel and everything. And then the rest of it is kind of, we're all pitching movies and game and merchandise. And
oh yeah, you have a comment in there that sent shivers a little bit. I think you say that it's the third biggest Hollywood event of the year, and when I heard you say that in listening to it, I was thinking, okay, he means the Oscars, and what you were talking about was where business gets done. And
exactly.
And you had Sundance, behind Sundance and Toronto, and I would say maybe behind Toronto, but it certainly, Sundance doesn't move the needle
anymore.
Not that way. Certainly not that way. It's still an important function for a variety of reasons, but an important function for fewer reasons, and the impact is smaller. Comic-Con is absolutely top two.
Absolutely. And it's no coincidence that now the top grossing movie of all time is Avengers Endgame, because it was those very producers 12 years ago marching around that convention going, look at all these people, and they're dressing up as these, who are these characters they're dressing up, and oh my God, never seen anything like this. We got to get the rights to this. And let's make this the product mocha load of, and then holy smokes, let's go back to Comic-Con and pitch this new movie that we're going to be doing 15 years from now. Gabbity, gabbity, blabbity, blab. And $2 billion later, and there you are.
And they're still doing it, right? Now,
they're still doing it.
Phase four, they announced, I think, 10 new projects, including a couple of series. But what everybody was coming away from was, oh, my God, they just announced 7 movies for 2021. 7 Marvel movies. Because they know they can get people into theaters, so why not have every movie that comes out be a Marvel movie? And and who knows? Maybe that's what we need. Maybe we need to get people more into the habit of going to movies.
Right.
Talk about how things have changed. You know, I remember coming of age in, you know, as a filmmaker, becoming a filmmaker in the 90s, and how so many people were decrying the fact that every movie was made for the 15 to 24-year-old demographic. The demographic I was just coming out of, I was now expected to turn around and exploit. Right? And there were a lot of people decrying it. Well, that very demographic, if you make it 18 to 24 now, has vanished utterly. And we used to talk about this in the podcast 12 years ago, where they were starting to vanish. And they're gone. They go to see, on average, one movie a year now. They're not in the multiplex every week like they were when I was that age. No, it's one movie a year, and it's a Marvel movie. Well, maybe they'll go to see every Marvel movie, and if they get into it, boy, you had better hope that your movie has its trailer connected to those movies.
Exactly, because that's your only chance to get their eyeballs. They're all, you know, everybody's on Fortnite and immersive games and VR, and there's so many other ways to entertain yourself and to not just sit there and be a passive, you know, participant in a plot structure, but you can now be the guy shooting the guy in your own movie.
And you know, it was this great thing where business got done because everyone was there for the love of this.
Right.
And the emphasis, again, is so heavy, you know, that the cart has tipped where not where it's not successful, obviously, but where the joy for a lot of us is gone. And it's not Comic-Con, it's Commerce-Con now. And, oh, look, there's a room of comics.
But it's not a room of comics. Here's everybody doing cosplay for their Instagram and their own web TV show, whatever, interviewing each other and getting the jump on the announcement of all the dumb.
My God. I'm so glad you brought that up, because this is a new thing. I never really thought about this, but this is an entire industry. This idea of how you get people in, you get people to pay a lot of money, because what you're promising them is great social media photo backgrounds. And
exactly.
Lily's immersive show that I told you about, the Alice in Wonderland G&T party, this immersive cocktail experience, that's why it sold thousands of tickets before ever opening. Because what it was promising, I'm realizing, and she's explaining to me, what it was promising was for those people who live on social media, a worthy photograph experience.
Right.
Like LACMA's Rain Room. You know, these kind of events that people are paying top dollar because we're promised great Instagram photos.
Right. And that gets eyeballs, and then you become an air quote influencer, and then you get free stuff supposedly, though I've seen signs up in restaurants here, anyone without less than 200,000 followers on Instagram doesn't get nothing free.
And you know, and so what's lost is the enjoyment. What's affected is the enjoyment for people who go to enjoy the show.
Yeah.
For people who want to appreciate the art, you know how I feel. I hate that they allow photographs now in art museums.
Yeah, right.
And I hate it on two fronts. One, because those screens are distracting. It can literally block your view, right? At concerts, it so often blocks the view, but it's also distracting, the lit up screen. But also the energy of anyone who is not present to what's going on affects your energy. You know it better than I would as a live comedy performer. If you've got, even in a packed house, If you've got one person who, for whatever reason, is actively not present, how many people around them are being affected and being pulled out? Certainly the people Absolutely. Next to them. And then if they start to talk about, hey, what's wrong? Are you okay? Are you, you know, is everything all right? Then the people behind them are distracted by the talking. So they're getting angry. Now the person behind them is distracted by that person's anger. And it ripples four or five rows deep all of a sudden. You've got an energetic hole in your audience.
Absolutely. This is how improv works. You actually have to work together and focus the crowd. And if you are in a realm where everybody is mediating their experience immediately by holding up phones or taking pictures or recording in whatever facet, then ultimately you are now on your back foot trying to get that crowd together. And it totally bugs me.
And you know, it's the
frankly,
analogy.
I think Comic-Con's a symptom and or a perpetrator. It's the ripple going in the other direction.
I used that analogy of, you know, the distracted audience. That's an analogy that I used to use when doing violence prevention, when people would say, oh, you know, I've never had my life has not been affected by violence. And I would always say, oh, so you've never met anybody before me. This is your first time meeting another human being. And that would be the example that I would use, you know, is that you are affected, even if you don't know it. And it's that ripple in the audience, that hole in the audience. Because honestly, nobody could ever have driven in a major city before without being affected by violence. You know, but so getting back to Comic-Con, obviously we were talking a lot about what proved to be a relaunch of Star Trek. Though, interestingly enough, right, not really the long-lasting relaunch of the movie series, but instead the relaunch of it on... there might be a fourth movie. It might end up being directed by Tarantino, but that's going to be totally afield from what Kurtzman, J.J. Abrams et al. Created back, you know, 12 years ago, and with the release of the first Star Trek movie, 2009, though I would argue, maybe more importantly, I suggested it back then, we talked about it, but certainly now, that four-part graphic novel series that Kurtzman wrote that filled in the story between Star Trek The Next Generation and the new J.J. Abrams classic Star Trek, and how that universe was created. That four-part graphic novel was certainly viable material to explore, and I kind of wished that miniseries had been made into the movie instead.
Because that was very helpful in terms of how that bridge worked
and what happened and what happened to the next gen characters after Next Generation. But guess what, nothing is lost, especially if it's in comic book form. So we're getting that, and we're getting that in a CBS All Access series called Star Trek Picard, which is set following the destruction of the Romulan homeworld in the original Star Trek universe. And the full trailer was released yesterday, this weekend, at Comic-Con.
Right, and their data's back, and Jerry Ryan is...
As Seven of Nine, a little bit of Voyager. How smart is that? First of all, we get to find out about what's going on with the Borg, it seems. That makes a lot of sense. And boy, you wonder, you know, she was a beloved character on Voyager, a not beloved iteration of Star Trek. Yeah. But boy, if Paramount's planning any kind of major re-release of Voyager onto Blu-ray or something, this was smart.
I know, right? Well, I got to think they, you know, with these things, there's not much left to chance. So they are systematically piecing and deconstructing and running everything up the flagpole and seeing who says yes to what, so that when it finally launches, it's going to have the most people.
Your review just now, I don't know if you didn't mean it as a review, but I think that's the perfect review of Star Trek Discovery for me. Was nothing was left to chance.
Right?
And therein lies the problem.
Exactly.
A show about exploring the frontiers of the known universe and what it means to be human. Let's plan it to the nth degree. As opposed to Roddenberry's original, you know, pitch, this is Wagon Train to the Stars.
Yeah, right? That's easier to do.
But
and you also come from a time, the 60s, less, you know, where there was less and more, you know. You had a smaller budget. You had to work around limitations, that kind of thing.
Well, McGoohan pitches The Prisoner when he wants out of his contract from John Drake. He's the highest paid actor in television as John Drake on Secret Agent. He wants out. It's frustrating. And, you know, the story editor, George Markstein, who is the co-creator of The Prisoner with him, says, well, Pat, what would happen if your character tried to resign? And therein lied the opportunity, right? And so they go to the owner of it, the man who owns his contract, Lou Grade, the great Lou Grade of ITC, and he pitches the idea to him. And in one pitch meeting, on a handshake, Lou Grade says, I don't understand your pitch idea at all, but it's so crazy it just might work. And that's how it's born, right? There isn't teams of marketing people, et cetera, planning it out, leaving nothing to chance. If you leave nothing to chance, what has been left out is the creative impulse, the creative spark, the possibility for brilliance. And those things, those ineffable things that are what we remember. And that brings us back, though, to why Star Trek Picard might have a chance, which is this is a character we might want to spend time with again after many years' absence. Like, you know, I haven't seen... I had this experience right back in New York before the engagement party we had in New York, Lily and I. I went and visited my high school debate partner, who I had not seen in some 25 years. And I came away thinking, you know, I need to make seeing her regularly. I mean, it's kind of like Picard. This first one is delightful, then if it fills me with love, not nostalgia, if seeing the new show of Picard fills me with love, then like seeing my old debate partner Sai again, I will say, yes, I want to visit this person every week.
Well, and this, I think, was the teaser, what was brilliant about it. Just to have him walk through a grape vineyard, it's like, you didn't love the science. You didn't love space and leotards and lasers and dilithium crystals. You love that character, and you'll follow that character even if he's sauntering through a vineyard that doesn't even have grapes on it, for crying out loud.
Well, you make a great, great point, because you're right. They completely eschewed any idea. They almost said, like, this isn't even going to be in space.
Yeah.
And yet we were, okay, fine. Sign me up. He's going to explore a vineyard, the final frontier.
And, totally. I can't wait for that wine.
And yet, then the trailer comes out and it's, no, this is a space adventure. And we go, good. But why it mattered is because literally they're grounding it, hence the Earth, right, in character, and telling you, who is this character? Who is Picard? Picard is one of the true, if not the truest, explorer Star Trek has ever depicted.
Yes.
A show that's supposed to be about exploration, but often wasn't. And at this time, isn't it nice in this era of darkness in which we live to see a white man of a certain age who is a philosopher and an explorer and someone who has always been grounded in a moral center.
Yes. Let us all aspire to that feller. If we could.
It's why I think if we can close the door on our discussion at Comic-Con, did you have anything else to add?
No, I sort of bummed myself out enough about it, I think.
Well, I think it's why maybe it isn't coincidence. You say, you know, they don't leave anything to chance. But, boy, that trailer drops on the weekend that we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the moon landing.
That's true.
And maybe that is not something that anybody realized. I doubt, Dean, that anybody realized when they were planning this out, because obviously they were always going to drop the trailer at Comic-Con.
Exactly.
And I think somebody probably in the days leading up to it or in the months leading up to it said, oh my God, if we can get that day, you know, that day is the 50th anniversary. But culturally, I think we do celebrate this 50th anniversary for much the same way that we celebrate Picard. We look hopefully, and by the way, two of those three men are still with us, right? Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins at 90, still alive. And, you know, these men who embodied so many things that we think we've lost.
Right. Have we lost it? I guess we have, eh?
Well, I think fear we've lost it. It's certainly in short. The idea of recalcitrance, of standing tall, standing firm, standing squarely in courage in the face of danger, walking tall and speaking softly, these are things that are not prevalent, not front and center in our society, which is a loud society.
It's true.
I don't know if you saw this, but there was an event in the Oval Office, ostensibly to fete the accomplishments of the men that walked on the moon, and Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins were there. And why I know it is because clips of it made all the news shows, because Trump took questions from reporters, and they were all about the aftermath of his racist tweets and the racist chant that broke out at his rally, the send her back, and questions of whether he really did, because he lied about how he didn't approve and didn't try to stop it. And so in this meeting, you know, he didn't like the coverage he got, so he claimed that he tried to stop them, and then he didn't like the coverage that he got about claiming that he tried to stop them, so now he reversed course on that. The usual playbook. And I only bring this up because all I could watch in this, and what almost no news show pointed out, was that that's Michael Collins and Buzz Aldrin standing in silence so uncomfortably on either side of the resolute desk while this exchange is going on. And it was this really disturbing reminder that no, these qualities still do exist, but you don't hear them because that's it. They're the qualities of people that are judged by their actions, not by their words.
Right. Now, that's true.
And we're parsing out every word imaginable now. That's where we live. And I would say this about words that are spoken, since we've dipped our toes into this. Dean, I don't want to see any more white people asked whether or not they think something is racist.
Yeah, how would they know?
Yeah. You want to know if something is racist? Let's ask some people of color if they found a statement racist. If they did, right. Argument's over. But we get so defensive about it. Well, that's not what I meant. That's not what I... Saying something racist does not actually mean you're a racist. Doing something racist does not mean that. What it might mean is that you were racially insensitive. And, oh, we can learn something, right? Oh, okay, saying that is not cool because I don't want to hurt anybody. So, I can learn how to use language more effectively and better. And, hey, I apologize. I am sorry if that hurt you. That was not my intent. And so thank you for teaching me, and I will do better. Nobody has any reason to feel shame at that moment. Everybody has reason to feel good because we've learned from each other, which is why we were put here in the first fucking place.
Is that the mic dropping? Did you just drop the mic?
Is that what it sounded like? Okay, that's the end of the show. That'd be just a great closing. Like, that's it. We just found the end of the show. We nailed the dismount. and there was never another Chill Pack Hollywood Hour again. But no, don't kid yourself. We've got other things to discuss. I didn't even want to really bring this up, except to say again, because this podcast is in some small way about conversation and the art of conversation and how we talk about these things and depict these things. And it does worry me that I see stuff and I feel like we are de-evolving. And one of the reasons we're de-evolving is, yes, you know that I believe firmly in the importance of freedom of expression, because that which we do not express, we suppress, and it becomes dangerous.
Right.
But expressing it does not mean we have to say the thing the moment it occurs to us in the form that it occurs to us. I tell my actors all the time in classes, you don't have to figure out how to say a line. You need to find the energy that the character is embodying in that moment, because it's the energy we embody that will always speak the line for us.
Wow, that's a good one.
And energy behind something is what creates the tone, and
right.
often the tenor, and often the words themselves, the word choices. And so express the thing that needs to get out, but don't express it in the first knee-jerk reaction you have. Dig down. What's the real message that you're trying to convey? But
right.
too often, what we're trying to convey and give to someone else is our feeling. And we're expressing that feeling through words rather than saying, okay, in this moment, I feel this. And I think the underlying cause is this, and this is how, you know, no, it's fuck you, basically. We've now given our bad feeling to someone else.
Right.
And we live in a culture that's too accepting of that. We've lost the thing that you don't ever chant, send her back. You don't ever chant, that's not acceptable. That's
yeah,
not
right.
acceptable. And you give people the opportunity then, when you say that is not acceptable, to realize, oh, I see why it's not acceptable. Wow, okay, no, I don't want to express it like that.
Right.
And I worry because we saw kids doing that, right? And that's
yeah,
where
right.
I mean we're de-evolving, because no child is born racist. No child is born knowing the differences between them. They have to learn these things. And so the good news is they can therefore learn to appreciate and celebrate the differences, a la Star Trek, right? Infinite diversity and infinite combinations. We can
right.
we can teach them to learn that, but not if we're allowing them to express themselves through their immediate, which is almost always basest, impulse.
Right. Yeah. And so it seems more challenging than the way you're putting it. It seems so the way you lay it out goes, well, that's an obvious solution right there. But then.
But it takes people taking responsibility for it. And we are not a culture designed to have people take a responsibility. People reject responsibilities. They hate responsibilities. Responsibilities are a burden. That's what we've been taught. Right.
Right.
Which is why, although we love to consider ourselves the land of the free, the home of the brave, none of us are brave enough to actually want freedom. Freedom terrifies us. And it's for that reason that freedom, i.e. freedom of speech, comes with it responsibility, right? As you and I have said before, freedom of speech does not mean freedom from responsibility.
Right.
But it's not a thing. Responsibility is not a burden. It is literally the ability to respond.
Rather
than react. Okay,
yeah.
50th anniversary, Dean, of the moon landing. Moved by it? Were you moved by it? How have you commemorated it?
Well, commemorated by launching a new streaming TV show called Gravity Hole of two guys forever stuck in space. How better to commemorate it than use my art?
You left nothing to chance.
I left nothing to chance. Exactly. Look at gravityhole.com for new episodes coming up all the time. We're about to, once it cools down and I don't have to survive on air conditioning, we're going to put a whole bunch of new shows up. And it's going to be live streaming, and watch for a whole live thing coming on the 24th, I think, the day everybody landed.
Okay, so that's at gravityhole.com? Is that what it is? No.
Yeah, well, it's going to be on my Facebook and my Twitter and my Instagram, and it's all going to be launched. It's a day and date.
All right.
Everything.
And we'll link to it. We'll link to it as we will link to gocomedy.net. You're doing a live improv show of The X-Files this week in Detroit.
Yes.
So I, as I mentioned, have watched a lot of space adventures, rewatching several of these. I mentioned the Claire Denis movie, A High Life, that I've watched, which is a really interesting piece. I'm so glad that I watched this. It's about, again, not a quote unquote pleasing film, but it's her first English language film. And it reminded me in some ways of Danny Boyle's Sunshine. Remember that?
Yeah, where they went to the sun in a big ship and then things go wrong?
To try to harness the energy of the sun, a desperate mission to harness the energy of the sun to create energy to save life on Earth.
Right.
And I'm glad you remember it because we actually were speaking about it 12 years ago this week on the very show that we excerpted earlier. We're talking about Comic-Con. And damn if this week I'm not watching a movie that reminds me just of that. And it's High Life from Claire Denis. Like I said, her first English language film. And that the fact that she chose this as her first English language film is what turned me around on this movie halfway through, where again I was going, why am I watching this? Why do I have to see these things? Why do I have to witness these things I'm not going to be able to unsee in this movie about prisoners, inmates who are allowed to volunteer for a space mission realistically of no return, where they're approaching 99% the speed of light. So therefore, time for them is passing at a much different rate than for the observer on Earth. Indeed, life on Earth has probably already ended long before they get to the black hole they are sent to in order to try to harness the gravitational energy that it possesses.
Oh, okay.
And it is quite the uncomfortable and unpleasant journey, I must say. And when I asked myself about halfway through, why is this her first English language film? When I suddenly started realizing this legendary filmmaker, I went, oh, well, it must be because, and then it dropped. This is her indictment of American culture.
Oh.
Because the spaceship itself is just this wired box, and everyone's trapped inside this wired box. And I went, oh, my God, the whole thing is an indictment of Western culture. And so I'll leave it at that. But in true, wonderful science fiction resonant, Gory. And so that breathed just life into every choice that was made. And so did I enjoy it? Yeah, actually I did, because I appreciated that someone was doing that. So I find that enjoyable. But I also admired it a great deal. And that suddenly then led me back to thinking about 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Oh, yes.
And with 50 years old as well. Much like me, much like the moon landing. It's 50 years old. And we all just get better and better. But I was thinking about how 2001 changed the industry because it was the first time that a science fiction film, which, let's face it, up until that time had been like a B-movie genre, right?
Right. Yeah, for sure.
Not that there weren't classics. Of course there were classics that we love. But it was taken seriously as art from this point forward.
Yeah.
Sci-fi movies were art. And that's it.
Yeah.
And that's it about Kubrick. Let's face it. I mean, Kubrick made nothing but these blockbusters, it seems, you know, like that, and Clockwork Orange and The Shining. I mean, blockbuster movies. But he was an art house filmmaker who somehow found himself in the multiplex. And
by the sheer quality. I mean, because he worked visually,
allegorically. I mean, here's the thing is that Hollywood tried to recreate the success of 2001, damn near bankrupting itself on so many occasions. And it wasn't until a low budget film, Star Wars, almost 10 years later, proves to Hollywood that, yeah, you were right. There are massive audiences for space adventures. But you'd been going after the intellectual angle on films that 2001 represented, but 2001 kind of belongs more alongside a Fellini 8.5 or an Antonioni film than it does a space opera like Star Trek or Star Wars.
Because of that ambiguous ending. I mean, gee whiz, the last.
Well, because of everything. Because he was, you know, he was an artist. He was painting on this canvas. And so I've been thinking about that because, the right stuff, when the right stuff comes out.
Yeah.
To great critical acclaim. It also was a box office disaster. It helped sink the Ladd Company, along with Blade Runner sinking the Ladd Company. Great films that stood the test of time that did no box office. But the right stuff, you get like 8 Oscar nominations, for crying out loud. I mean, it was hailed. It was acclaimed. And yet, how much of a failure was it? Well, me and my friends, we were in high school. We went to see it on opening day. And outside the Century 21 there in San Jose, a car with dark windows pulls up and the windows roll down. And there's Charles Frank, one of the stars of the movie, in the parking lot. And he asks us, hey, guys, did you just see it? And we said, yeah, it was awesome. You're him. You're the guy. And we're so excited. And he goes, yeah. And he's smiling and he's so happy that we loved it. And he said, so big crowd? And we went, define big. And, it's an afternoon showing on the first day. And he said, hopefully, well, like Star Wars, right? Like this is what they expected. This was Star Wars Mach 2. And finally, I couldn't hold it back. And I blurted out, you're going to have to lower your expectations.
Oh, no.
And he looked at me and I said, yeah, you see us? Yeah. You're going to get good word of mouth from us because we were alone in the theater. And I just remember him slinking down and he never had the Mark Hamill-esque career that he was hoping for. So why do I bring this up? I bring this up because, again, I watch it now and Philip Kaufman, who had directed the very, very good remake of Invasion of the Body Snatchers in 78, he directs The Right Stuff, fresh off writing, I think it's Raiders of the Lost Ark. But Right Stuff owes more to Kubrick than it does to Lucas and Spielberg. Right Stuff shows that as a director, he was art house. And that's the way he went from there, Philip Kaufman. I think he did Unbearable Lightness of Being after that. So Right Stuff wants to be in the art house, not in the multiplex. And it works on that level, and it's wonderful to watch now. It's so rich, and it feels good being in that world that it created. But these things like tone and atmosphere, which movies like 2001 and The Right Stuff create, are, again, things that large portions of the population avoid.
Right.
Because why?
It's hard to sell. Well, you can't sell tone.
But for another reason, because the things are being sold in a different way altogether. Why I want to go to something like, look, I enjoy a good selfie as much as the next person. But why do I want to go to the Rain Room? Why do I want to go to art installations? Why do I want to go to an immersive theater experience? Because I want to be able to soak up the feeling, the atmosphere, the tone.
Right.
But if I'm going entirely to document my visit there for my social media presence, I'm not present to it at all, even though I'm standing there.
That's true.
And this is why so many great places that we love are getting torn down now, because you can't quantify, monetize, again, how it makes you feel to be at a place.
Right. You're just bumming me out left, right, and center on this show.
I don't mean to be doing that, but, it should make you feel good that there is a place where we can come together and we can talk about these things. And and talk about these things we have. We've talked a little bit about how 2001 changed things. Yes. You know, how the 60s were an exciting time because the 60s were a time when art house films could be huge hits. Not only a 2001, but foreign language films were huge hits. Fellini's La Dolce Vita was a huge, huge box office hit. In fact, I think it wasn't until, what, like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and Amelie that foreign language films would prove to be the box office successes that they were in the 60s when people wanted to immerse themselves in unique experiences,
right?
Rather than give me a plot, entertain me, divert me. I want to be immersed in a life experience. And so what we saw by the 80s, of course, was we'd separated that stuff out. There's art house, there's commerce, and never the twain shall meet.
Right.
But that changes 25 years ago, Dean, at Cannes, on La Croisette, when quite unexpectedly, the final chapter of Krzysztof Kieslowski's thematic trilogy, Red, White, and Blue, Trois Couleurs, Rouge, is released. And it is expected to win the Palme d'Or, but it loses out. Krzysztof Kieslowski, such an important director that, a little bit shockingly to me, I must admit, in 2002, in the Sight and Sound poll, he is hailed as one of the 10 most important directors of all time, just six years after his death. His final movie is beat at for the Palme d'Or by Quentin Tarantino's second movie, Pulp Fiction.
Wow.
And it's hard to remember this and wrap your head around this, but to realize that Quentin Tarantino, with Reservoir Dogs, an art house filmmaker, and but Pulp Fiction changes things. It wins the Palme d'Or, which is all about being an art house movie. The French are not voting for the popcorn movies to win the Palme d'Or. They give it to Pulp Fiction, giving it the imprimatur of art house excellence, par excellence. And it makes over $100 million at the box office.
Wow.
And things,
so there you go.
Things change at that point where there becomes something that I like to call the smart house.
Ah.
Popcorn box office movies that we cineasts can love because they're smart. And Tarantino has specialized in this, has he not?
Right. Smart house.
Kubrick made genre films. He did horror. He did war. Right. He did science fiction. And they were genres that he explored, but he brought his own art house nature to them. Quentin Tarantino deconstructs genres.
Yes.
In a way that we can ascribe as being very intellectual. And yet, the energy behind them is, to me, the very same energy that created the genres in the first place. The gee whiz, whiz bang, daring do, and thrill ride mentality.
I agree with that, for sure. You know, there's beefs I have with Mr. Tarantino, of course, but it is, there is an energy and a love for these genres and understanding of the impulse, the artistic impulse to get this up and off the ground and going that I do doff my hat to for every Tarantino movie out there.
Well, you know, and we're 50 years removed from 2001: A Space Odyssey. And this week, 25 years after Pulp Fiction changes things, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is coming out. And set in the late 60s. Set in an era 50 years ago. Nothing is left to chance, Dean. And so all these things are weaving together in my mind. And what an interesting mirror to Kubrick Tarantino is. They are so different, their movies, and yet there's some big similarities. Not the least of which is the amount of movies. These are not people who made a lot of movies. I think Kubrick made 12, and Tarantino said he's going to retire after his 10th, right?
Wow.
And they don't make movies often. Kubrick, you know, was less prolific through the years than, obviously, Tarantino. Tarantino hasn't let the same amount of time span, but he takes his time on these things. And they cover a lot of the same genre ground. And they are, interestingly, to me, both mirrors, not only for each other, but for where we're at culturally, but they also are filmmakers that have driven culture in ways that very few filmmakers anymore can. And in the case of Kubrick, in a way that very few filmmakers could match, right?
Right.
Because when you combine that, it's still a magical combination. When you can combine critical acclaim with award acclaim with box office acclaim, you're moving the needle. And very few filmmakers have done that over a stretch of movies the way that those two men have. And Kubrick kept certain things alive. And maybe in his own way, Tarantino has too, which is just the love of movies.
Right.
But and both of them, the desire to imitate them led to real crises in the industry. In the 90s, remember when everybody was trying to make their Tarantino films?
Yeah.
And they were all terrible. And here we were talking about how the effort to recreate 2001's success almost bankrupted things.
Yeah, right? Oh, my gosh.
So
that's true.
All right. We're over again, but I hope this was an interesting, I had a lot of fun talking about this. I feel better, but I'm the emotional portrait of Dorian Gray, because I feel great. And meanwhile, in a closet is a portrait of Dean Haglund sobbing.
Damn you, Phil Lernes. Oh my gosh.
Okay.
No,
so
you know what? It's uplifting. There's uplift at the end.
And you, my friend, are going to be trotting the boards again in your one-man improv show this week. Can't wait to hear about it. GoComedy.net. Tickets are available. I will link to it. Gravity Hole relaunching again. When is that?
Well, we were thinking the 24th, but that might be jamming all too much together. So maybe the weekend, so the 27th.
So still possibly before then. So pay attention. Obviously, we'll share it on the Facebook site, facebook.com/chillpackhollywood. If you don't already, like the show there, and you can keep up to date. That's a pretty good portal that always links to the things you and I have going on. And right. On Twitter as well, twitter.com/chillpackhollywood. We did get an email, Dean, that we'll cover next week. From a loyal listener. We got that at chillpackhollywood @yahoo.com. And so, we'll open up the mailbag next week. So if anybody wants to write us and wants us to talk about things, please write us.
Let us know.
All right.
That's what we mean when you say it's your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
Oh, truer words never spoken, Dean Haglund. You left nothing to chance. Till next week, I'm Phil Lernes.
I'm Dean Haglund.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.